Pension records and other sources tell us that at least 400 women served in the Army, served as soldiers, dressed up like men and served as soldiers, fought in the armies. That estimate might be low, at least 400. One woman who served with the Sanitary Commission in the Western Theater claimed that she knew 50 women who were passing as soldiers, just in the area that had come under her view. There were various reasons for women to go into the Army and fight, and they ranged from those who were unmarried and patriotic and wanted to do their part, to those who followed their husbands into the service, wanted to be near their husbands, as closely tied to their husbands as they could. And there were instances of prostitutes who were passing as soldiers, who would carry weapons but would also ply their trade when the armies weren't engaged in an active campaign. Northern women were more than twice as likely to enter the Army. And again, I think that's partly because the war seemed far off and maybe a bit more romantic in some ways to them. The war was right in the southern neighborhoods, and most southern women didn't think they needed to join the Army. Most women who were found out for one of two reasons. They were either wounded, and the physicians, if they were any good at all, could tell that this was a woman they were treating and not a man, or they became pregnant, and they were given away that way. Many women who did serve were not doing it secretly in terms of what their immediate unit knew. Many men in the units would know that there were women, and they would sort of keep their secret with them. So at least 400 and maybe more. Women also served as spies and what were called camp followers. Most famous spies were Rose O'Neill Greenough and Belle Boyd on the Confederate side. Their exploits are typically overplayed, although they did provide some useful information. They and many unknown, unnamed women who would have pointed out directions or relayed useful information. There are not as many Union spies because the activity, again, is in the Confederacy. The most famous Union spy in the South was a woman named Elizabeth Van Loo, who lived in Richmond and passed along a great deal of useful information to the United States. Now, camp followers would have included women who acted as laundresses, as teamsters, runaway slaves would have fit into this group. They're women who followed along with the armies. Many of them were from lower classes. They're not all middle class, although a significant proportion of these camp followers were wives of officers. Some who were very determined to follow their husbands as much as they could. A British soldier who was at Brandy Station in 1863 said that he saw 50 women in camp whom he considered ladies. He said they were upper-class women who added great tone to the camp near Brandy Station, who brought much to the conversation around the campfire. More camp followers were Southern women than Northern. Proximity, again, played an important role. And most were not the stereotypical prostitutes. Camp follower has a negative connotation many times. Most of these women were not prostitutes following the armies. Many of them added to the sense of community in camp, organizing religious services, helping out with hygiene, and so forth. But they weren't all uplifting. There were plenty of prostitutes with the armies, especially armies that were close to cities. Hordes of prostitutes would descend on the environs of the army. A Georgia soldier wrote home, a man named Theodore Fogel wrote home, that camp life was not uplifting. He said he was shocked to see women dressed in inappropriate ways. He said, "I don't like their looks. They're too free and easy." That was a nice way to say that he thought there were some loose women too close to his unit. Very large rates of venereal disease in both Union and Confederate armies during the war, and on more than one occasion, both armies took steps to try to keep prostitutes away from the soldiers. All right, just a few words about the impact of the war on women. It did create more opportunities, especially in the North, and women who went into the public sphere often carried that experience later into the 19th century with them. Opportunities opened for work in health care, as we've seen. The secretaries and sales clerks, mainly a late 19th century phenomenon, but some of that began during the war. So there is some of this enlarging of the women's sphere. In the South, more white women had to do field work, while similar work for black women became secondary, especially at least in the short term when many of the slaves were freed and they tried to avoid that kind of work. Domestic service, however, was still reserved for black people almost entirely. Teaching became more respectable as an outlet for women. In terms of marriage and family roles, it's unclear yet the exact extent of this impact, but women after the war could remain spinsters without the antebellum stigma attached to that position. The fact that there were so many war widows after the war made people more sympathetic to single women, and more women remained as unmarried heads of households. There's been a debate about whether women becoming disaffected with the war actually hurt the Confederate war effort. I think the stronger arguments are on the other side of that, that women, in fact, were a main support for the war and not really a kind of interior weakness for the Confederate war effort. Many women underwent a similar kind of hardening process as men did during the war. They saw things and experienced things they simply hadn't seen before. We'll leave women here, the North and the Confederacy's women, and return to the battlefront. We'll rejoin Ulysses S. Grant as he becomes General-in-Chief of the Union armies.